This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 40, Kalia McNabb, part 1. On October 7th, 2017, Newton County Sheriff's officers responded to a mobile home park just south of Covington, Georgia, where a couple claimed their two-week-old daughter, Kalia McNabb, had gone missing from their trailer within a time frame of less than an hour in broad daylight. The next day, Kalia's tiny body was found in the woods just a three-minute walk from the family's trailer. Based on inconsistencies in the couple's stories and bizarre behavior on the part of the father, including jumping out of a car and taking off on foot when he found out the baby had been discovered, police took Christopher McNabb into custody, and within days of Kalia's death, he faced multiple charges related to her murder. A few months later, Kalia's mother, Courtney Bell, was also arrested on charges relating to the baby's death. This is a tale of petty crime, drug addiction, and domestic violence, with a dash of incest. This is part one of the story of Kalia McNabb, a little girl who never had a chance. My sources for today's episode were The Covington News, 11 Alive, Channel 2 Atlanta, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Crime Online, Court TV, WGAU Radio, the Explore Georgia website, Wikipedia, and court documents. Before I dive headfirst into the cesspool of this story, I want to give a shout-out to my newest patron, Maya from Denmark. Thank you so much for your support, Maya. Every pledge brings me that much closer to my goal of committing myself full-time to the podcast and to Suffer the Little Children blog on a permanent basis, even post-quarantine. If you've recently pledged and haven't received a shout-out on the show or an email from me, please send me an email at sufferthelittlechildrenpod@gmail.com or a Facebook message on Suffer the Little Children podcast page and let me know. If anyone else would like to pledge a monthly contribution, please visit sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com and click Become a Patron in the upper right corner. Or if you'd rather make a one-time donation, you can visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com/support. Thank you, everyone. I truly appreciate every last one of my readers and listeners. As I told my family over Thanksgiving dinner, I'm beyond thankful to have the ability to be a voice for all these abused and murdered children whose voices were stolen by those they trusted. I hope you all had a peaceful, love-filled, socially distant Thanksgiving as well. Now, steel yourselves. I'm about to tell you a story that will likely piss you off just as much as it did me. The first character I'll introduce you to in this dollar store Shakespearean tragedy is Daddy Dearest, because he is most definitely a character. I think it's important before we get into Kalia's story to understand what a bone-deep dirtbag her father truly is. Christopher Michael McNabb was born on March 23, 1990, to parents Donna and Michael. When he was young, Chris was unruly to say the least. Reportedly, Donna couldn't handle her son's behavior. Chris was described as a child from hell. For one reason or another, she left him with his father, Michael McNabb, who raised Chris from a young age in and around Cartersville, Georgia. Chris was 14 when his bad behavior first started involving law enforcement. He was investigated in December of 2004 in regard to an altercation in Cartersville, but he wasn't arrested for the first time until the age of 15 on June 29, 2005, when he was charged with criminal trespassing and stolen property. A little over a week later, on July 7, 2005, Michael reported 15-year-old Chris as a runaway. Police found him at the Best Western on Highway 20 and returned him to his father. On July 12th of the same year, Michael called police for a domestic violence offense, saying his son stole a pack of cigarettes from him. He had to tackle Chris to stop him from leaving the property, and Chris subsequently punched a hole through the kitchen wall. Chris told police his dad hit him 20 times with a closed fist and beat him with a belt, but when police asked him to remove his shirt, they saw no visible injuries. Chris was charged with criminal trespassing again and damage to private property. A week later, on July 19th, Chris's stepmother, 26-year-old Crystal Abbotts, called to report him for burglary. She said he forcibly entered her deadbolted bedroom and stole more than $7,000 worth of jewelry. Michael told police they had put the deadbolt on the door after, the previous week, Chris stole $315 from his dad's wallet, got a cab and left, bought marijuana, and rented a hotel room. Michael reported Chris as a runaway yet again in October of 2005, and then for a fourth time in December after Chris cut off his ankle bracelet and fled the house. Chris either took a little break from petty crime or found himself in juvie because it wasn't until almost a year later, on September 11, 2006, when Michael called police and reported a domestic incident in which Chris charged him, pushing him onto the couch. Chris was charged in this incident with battery, family violence, and, once again, running away. In June of 2007, Chris, then age 17, took his criminal enterprise to the next level when he started repeatedly breaking into a business called Woods Fabrication in Taylorville, stealing vehicles on the premises and ramming them through the facility's chain-link fence. In June, it was a white 2006 four-door Ford F-350 truck. For that incident, he was arrested and charged with two counts of theft by taking, criminal trespassing, criminal damage to property, entering automobile, theft of automobile, damage to property, business, and larceny theft of articles in a vehicle. Within the same month, Chris pulled the same stunt twice more, the second time with a 1989 Ford truck. This one earned him charges of theft by taking, criminal trespassing, criminal damage to property, theft of automobile, and damage to property, business. The third incident took place on June 27, 2007, when Woods Fabrication owner Ricky Woods called police and reported that his business had been hit with the fifth break-in within a short time frame. This time, Chris broke into the garage and stole a white 1964 Buick Skylark and, predictably, crashed it through the gate. Yet again, he was charged with burglary, criminal trespassing, criminal damage to property, theft by taking, burglary, damage to private property, and theft of automobile. Imagine a 17-year-old kid racking up all these felony charges and flat-out refusing to learn his lesson. This guy's not only a scumbag criminal, but clearly a moron as well. And refused to learn he did because 3 days after that last incident, Chris stole a vehicle from a house where he had been hanging out, as well as a PlayStation 2 console. For this, he was charged with burglary, theft by taking, burglary with no forced entry, and larceny. The very next day, Chris was captured on security camera once again at Woods Fabrication. Bartow County Sheriff's deputies arrested him and charged him with burglary and forced entry. This time, he spent a few years in prison for his bad behavior. He was incarcerated in January of 2008 and released on June 30, 2011. Just 5 weeks later, on August 1st, Michael McNabb reported that his 21-year-old son had both damaged and stolen his 2007 Ford Escape. The Coweta County Sheriff's Office responded to that complaint. In the meantime, just after midnight, a Fayette County Sheriff's Office deputy saw Chris turn left off Highway 85 onto Highway 54 in the stolen SUV, heading west in the eastbound lane. The vehicle then made an abrupt turn into a parking lot behind the old courthouse tavern. Chris didn't stop after the officer turned on his emergency lights, which started a pursuit that reached speeds of up to 68 miles per hour, during which he hit a curb, flattening the left front tire of his dad's vehicle. He continued to drive until he stopped in a parking lot and fled on foot. He was located around 2 a.m. and charged with driving on a suspended license, driving on the wrong side of the roadway, speeding, stop sign violation, failure to maintain lane, and felony fleeing. Michael McNabb told police he had hoped his son, who had just finished a stint in prison, would straighten his life up. That not only seemed unlikely, but damn near impossible. On August 23rd, Chris once again violated his probation. He was arrested for this on September 2nd. Somehow, he managed to stay out of prison for a while, but that, once again, would not last long. Courtney Marie Bell was born on March 29, 1993, to mother Pamela Sue Hamby and father Timothy Wade Bell. Her mother wasn't involved in her life from a very early age, and Courtney was raised by her paternal grandparents and her father, who had guardianship over her. Courtney was the middle of Pam's seven children, all of whom reportedly had different fathers, although Courtney didn't know Pam was her mother until she was 12 years old. She apparently believed the woman she barely knew was a family friend until she was searching the family car for a cigarette and found instead the bracelet affixed to her by the hospital when she was born, which bore her date of birth and Pamela Hamby's name. She then made it a point to get to know her mother, although they were never close and had a rocky relationship. In 2013, when she was about 20, Courtney's mother, Pam, introduced her to 23-year-old Christopher McNabb. This was truly a match made in hell for so many reasons. Chris was 5 feet 10 inches tall and weighed about 150 pounds, with brown eyes, brown hair, and a tweaky little goatee. He was instantly attracted to Courtney, who had long brown hair, blue eyes, stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, and had a slim figure at 150 pounds. The attraction was certainly mutual. The only problem was that the two were blood related. See, Chris's dad, Michael McNabb, and Courtney's mother, Pam Hamby, were brother and sister. So while Chris and Courtney weren't raised together and only met for the first time in their early 20s, they were first cousins by blood. Oh, did I say that was a problem? Let's just say Chris and Courtney didn't see it that way. They started dating in 2013, breaking up at one point, which might have had something to do with Chris's 3-month prison stint from April through the end of June 2013, or maybe it had more to do with his arrest in September of 2013 for shoplifting $160-odd worth of merchandise from a CVS and then providing a false name to law enforcement when questioned about it by a Newton County Sheriff's officer. Oh, and then he spent a little time in Fayette County Jail, where on December 8, 2013, he got himself into more hot water when he refused to go into his cell for lockdown, and then knocked over Sergeant Thomas Lowery, who was trying to handcuff him. Chris was escorted from the unit and slapped with a charge of obstruction of an officer for that one. Are you picking up a pattern with this guy yet? The hits just keep on coming. Regardless, Chris and Courtney rekindled their romance and got back together for good on April 15, 2014. Courtney and Chris may or may not have been officially engaged, but it wasn't long before they considered themselves married, despite never legally marrying. Georgia law prohibits marriage between first cousins, so they couldn't even if they wanted to. Just so we're clear, the definition of incest is having sex with someone you can't marry because you're too closely related. About his relationship with Courtney, Chris later told police,
"We didn't ever meet until 2013, and when we met, it was like, we knew who we were to each other, but we never knew each other, and you can't stop what you feel from the get-go. The very first time I ever met her, I knew I loved her. I've never felt about a girl the way I felt about Courtney, and she felt the same way, and it was wrong, but I don't apologize for it, because I love her. I can't help how my heart feels. And she's the same. She felt the same way. I mean, it's embarrassing to people. It embarrasses my dad, but he dealt with it because of the babies."
That's correct. I said babies. The two lovers, slash cousins, procreated not once, but twice. Within a couple months of Chris and Courtney getting back together in April of 2014, Courtney's IUD apparently fell out, so she became pregnant. She had previously been pregnant by someone else, giving birth to a stillborn baby on October 28, 2012. This time, however, she carried a perfectly healthy baby to term, and in February of 2015, the couple's first daughter, who I'll call Cece, was born. Chris, however, wasn't around for the first year and a half of that baby's life. He was never not a lawless shitbag. While Courtney was pregnant, on October 1, 2014, Chris fled the scene while the Newton County Sheriff's Office was serving an arrest warrant on someone else, so naturally, deputies followed him. During the foot chase, one of the deputies was hit in the face by a branch, which left a cut on his eyelid. The deputies caught Chris, who, at the time, had several warrants out of both Coweta and Fayette counties. For this fiasco, Chris was charged with willful obstruction of a law enforcement officer by use of threats or violence, obstruction or hindering a law enforcement officer, simple battery on an officer, and terroristic threats and acts. Around the same time, possibly while in county jail, Chris apparently embarked on a quest to cover himself in tattoos, including his neck and several on his face. He got the phrase, "face up or lace up," emblazoned across his forehead and the word "loyalty" over his right eyebrow, in addition to some random music notes and what looks like a backward treble clef on his right cheekbone. There would be plenty more where those came from. I'll include Chris's multitude of mugshots demonstrating the progression of his various looks through the years in the Facebook album for this episode. Sporting his increasing blood ink level, Chris spent about 14 months in Macon State Prison from July of 2015 until September of 2016. During this time, Courtney and little Cece lived with Courtney's dad, Tim Bell, and his parents, Jack and Barbara Bell. When Chris was released from prison on September 2, 2016, he apparently forged a close bond with his daughter, who was by then about 19 months old. Around the time Cece turned 2, Courtney once again became pregnant. In May or June of 2017, Chris, pregnant Courtney, and their 2-year-old daughter moved into a mobile home in Lot 31 of the Eagle Point Mobile Home Park at 12145 Highway 36 in Covington, Georgia. Covington is known as a film town where several high-profile television series have filmed, including In the Heat of the Night, The Dukes of Hazzard, and more recently, The Vampire Diaries, as well as about 140 movies, according to the Explore Georgia website. The same website boasts that downtown Covington was named one of Southern Living magazine's prettiest small towns in Georgia in 2017. As of last year, the population of Covington was a little over 14,000. The mobile home park itself was no stranger to horrific domestic violence crimes. On August 16, 2000, the same trailer park, which was then called Pine Valley, was the site of a triple filicide. A man named William David Riley Sr. set his family's trailer on fire, killing his 3 children, 6-year-old Ashley, 5-year-old William, and 3-year-old Samantha. Bill's girlfriend and a friend who was staying with them managed to escape the fire. Bill had previously threatened to burn the trailer to the ground rather than face eviction, and even more chillingly, he had made statements that he would see his children dead before he would let the Department of Family and Children's Services, or DFACS, take them. In 2004, Bill was convicted on 3 counts of malice murder and 2 counts of first-degree arson and sentenced to death. He currently awaits the completion of his sentence on Georgia's death row. The trailer on Lot 31 where Chris, Courtney, and Cece lived had 2 bedrooms, but rather than set up one of the bedrooms for the kids, the whole family slept in the master bedroom with the adults in a king-size bed and the 2-year-old in a toddler bed crammed between the adult bed and the wall. The trailer's second bedroom was, as Courtney later put it, a toy room, although from the crime scene photos, it appears the room actually functioned more for storage. They kept a mattress in the room as well as mountains of clothing. Because the family had no dressers, more clothing was kept in large plastic Rubbermaid-type tote bins in the master bedroom and lining the hallway. Chris, Courtney, and little Cece basically lived in poverty. Courtney was a stay-at-home mother, while Chris worked sporadically with his dad, Michael McNabb, who installed gas lines into local homes. Chris later told investigators he made anywhere from $350 to $700 a week, but it seems the $700 weeks were few and far between. Chris and Courtney collected food stamps, and Michael frequently sent them money to pay the bills using Walmart's store-to-store money transfer service. They had no washer and dryer, so they often wore their clothes multiple times without washing them. Now, I'm well aware that money doesn't buy happiness and that people living in poverty can be excellent, loving parents, happy people, and wonderful romantic partners. In this story, however, that was anything but the case, which will soon become crystal clear. One incident exemplifying the less-than-ideal conditions in the home took place on August 22, 2017, when another resident of the mobile home park called 911 to report a disturbance at Lot 31.
You need to send the police down here because Lot 31 is busting windows out of the trailer. And the landlord, my landlord done said, I called him, he said,
tell me who's hang busting up the
and call the law.
Who is busting the windows out?
The people that reads 31, Lot 31.
So the tenants, are they moving out?
Don't know, but they're busting, they're living there. They're renting it. And he busted windows, started busting windows out and started cussing me.
That call was a sign of far worse things to come. On September 23, 2017, a tiny, beautiful miracle entered the world when, 4 weeks premature, Kalia Claire Noella McNabb was born, weighing 5 pounds, 6 ounces. She was a perfect little doll with dark blue eyes, a good amount of fine dark brown hair, and a tiny mole hidden in her hairline on the left side of her forehead. Kalia was born with a possible clubfoot on the right side. Clubfoot is a fairly common birth defect in which a baby's foot is twisted inward. Pediatrician Ghazala Khalid later gave Courtney a referral to an orthopedic specialist, telling her the condition would easily be corrected by putting a cast on Kalia's foot to straighten it out. Courtney was discharged from the hospital after 2 days, but because Kalia's white blood cell count was high, she was kept for another 48 hours in the neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, where she received IV antibiotics to ensure there was no bacteria in her blood before she went home. During her stay in the hospital, Kalia, who was solely formula-fed, lost a few ounces, which is common in newborns. She dropped from 5 pounds 6 ounces to 4 pounds 9 ounces, but by the time she was discharged on September 25th and picked up from the hospital by both of her parents, she was back up to 5 pounds 1 ounce. Chris McNabb didn't have a phone of his own. The only phone in the house was Courtney's, but at the end of September, she dropped hers in Walmart and broke it. On October 1st, Courtney showed up on the doorstep of her cousin, Megan Sorrells, who lived in a mobile home park almost right across the street from theirs. Courtney asked to borrow Megan's prepaid cell phone, which Megan willingly handed over. Then Courtney left 2-year-old Cece and 8-day-old Kalia with Megan, who had 4 kids of her own, all of whom were school-aged. Courtney didn't tell Megan where she was going, how long she'd be gone, or when she'd be back. It didn't take long for Megan to become overwhelmed with the 2 extra little ones in her house, especially considering one was a newborn who was up repeatedly throughout the night for feedings. After a couple of days, Megan called her mom, Courtney's Aunt Kim, to vent. Kim subsequently called her brother, Courtney's dad, Tim Bell, to let him know what was going on. On October 3, 2017, Tim, along with his parents, Jack and Barbara, arrived at Megan's trailer, loaded Cece and Kalia into Jack's PT Cruiser, and took the kids home with them. Months before, Tim had given Courtney another PT Cruiser to use. Chris McNabb later told police he paid $600 in advance for 6 months of insurance on the car, with the understanding that it was going to be Courtney's vehicle. Tim, however, still had a key to that car, and on the way home with the kids, he, Jack, and Barbara stopped by the Eagle Point Mobile Home Park and picked up the car Courtney had been using, which was parked outside her trailer. Chris looked outside and saw that Courtney's family had just pulled up, so he took off out the back door of the trailer so he didn't have to deal with them. He apparently had a contentious relationship with them, which he would talk about in more detail during a later police interview. Also present at the time was Courtney's friend and nearby neighbor Melissa Missy Taylor, whose car was also parked outside. When Courtney saw Cece's head pop up in the back seat of Pawpaw Jack's car, she stormed outside and snatched her daughter out of the car, transferring her into Missy's car, where Missy and Chris were already sitting. Missy then drove off, taking the family to another friend's house on Woodlawn Road. During the incident, Courtney made this call to 911.
Newton County 911, what's the address of your emergency?
Hello?
Yes, can I help you?
My dad and them came to my house. My dad and my grandparents came to my house. They had my little girl in the car. I took my little girl. They went to my cousin's house where my kids were and took my newborn that I just had, and they took my car.
Why did they do that?
So that they were taking my kids.
All right. What address did they take them from?
12145 Highway 36, Covington, Georgia 30014.
All right. 12145 Highway 36?
Yes.
Okay. Is that Eagle Point?
Yes.
What lot number?
30.
30?
31, ma'am. And I came to a friend's.
Where are you at now?
Sarah. I'm sorry?
Where are you at now?
I'm trying to find my friend to get her address. Hey, what's your address? What is your address? Woodlawn Road.
Okay. Do you know where your parents went to?
Yes, their house.
Which is where?
Drive.
So they just showed up at your cousin's house and took
Yes, ma'am. It's crazy.
And they didn't give you a reason why?
They said that they were taking my kids, that I had left them at my cousin's house for a whole day and a whole night. And, I mean, I don't feel an issue with that. My cousin has kids, and they were playing over there.
Okay, so did your cousin contact them to come pick them up?
No, not at all. I've talked to her. And she lives right there at the village park, like not even a quarter mile from Pine Valley, Eagles Point.
Okay, and you did not give them permission to take the kids?
No, ma'am, I did not. I got my daughter, my two-year-old, and they went back to my cousin's house and got my newborn. My kids spent the night with my cousin.
Uh-huh.
And they came today and took them.
Okay, so do you have your two-year-old right now, or they have them?
Yes, she was in the car with my papa and my nanny when they all pulled up. And I took her out. And then a lady I know gave us a ride to my friend's house.
Okay, hold on just a moment for me, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, ma'am, what is your name?
Courtney Dell.
You said Courtney Dell?
Yes, C-O-R-T-N-E-Y.
Alright, what's your phone number you're calling from?
I'm not sure. It's my cousin's phone. She let me borrow it. Mine broke yesterday.
Okay, so I'm going to send a deputy to you on Woodlawn Road, correct? Because that's where you are currently.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, they'll be there with you shortly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Courtney's father, Tim, also called 911 to notify authorities about the incident.
Newton County 911, where's your emergency?
Yes, ma'am. Can you send the police out to my house? It's Drive, Cousin Georgia, 30014.
Yes, Drive. What's going on there?
Yes, ma'am. It's containing my grandchildren. You have got a police dispatch now. I'm on the phone with my daughter, but she won't let me talk to the police, okay?
Okay.
She left both her kids. They abandoned both her kids last night at my niece's house. My niece called me today at 4:30. Could not get in touch with her or the daddy. I went and picked one of the youngins up, the two-week-old up. She snatched the two-year-old out of the car, so I come on home, okay? Well, I called Mr. Philip Bradford. Mr. Philip Bradford is one of my buddies. He worked for the city police department when I got back home to find out what I needed to do, okay? He supposed to be sending me a number through text for the 1-800 for the defax number to where you can call them, okay?
So right now, hold on one second, let me try to figure this out. So right now, you have the baby right now?
I have the two-week-old baby sitting on my kitchen table in there.
Okay, yes, all right. And so your daughter is not there right now, the daughter or the father of the baby?
No.
So you just have questions
no.
on what you can do with about the situation?
The father, I think he is on the run from the police, okay?
Okay. And where does your daughter live?
Well, she lives at the trailer park on 36. Used to be Pine Valley. I think it's Eagles Landing or something like that now.
Okay, hold on one second.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Okay. What's your name?
My name is Tim Bell. I am, the grandfather.
Okay. And what's a good telephone number for you?
You can get me on my cell phone.
Okay, well, they're out there right now, I think, with them. So then they're going to come over there to you at Drive.
Yes, ma'am.
And then talk to you, okay?
Yes, ma'am. What the problem was, I went and took my car back, okay? That's the whole problem, all right?
Okay, I understand.
The way I feel about it, they abandoned them youngins yesterday. Okay,
Right.
So anyway, the police is going to come out.
Yeah, they're coming out there to you. They're out there right now at Eagle Point talking to them, and they're going to come over there and talk to you, okay? So you'll just wait right there, okay?
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
According to a later police interview, the officer who responded, Officer Bartlett, told Courtney that he would rather not get DFACS involved. Courtney said he told her that if she trusted her father and grandparents and felt safe with her kids being with them, she should let the kids go with them for a couple of days until everything blew over. Courtney acquiesced, and her Aunt Kim came and took Cece to Courtney's grandparents' house, where Kalia already was. While Chris and Courtney were apparently fine with their children being in the temporary custody of Tim, Jack, and Barbara, they could not abide by their car being out of their hands. They tried to devise ways to sneak the car off the property without Tim's knowledge, but because of the way he had parked it, there was no way to get it past him. They ended up telling Tim he could keep the kids for a little while, as long as he gave the car back. They did, however, want their children returned to them ultimately, so Tim told Courtney that if she cleaned up the trailer, which was an utter pigsty, he would return Cece and Kalia. On October 6, 2017, Tim Bell returned the girls to their parents. It would be the seventh night Kalia would spend with either or both of her parents, including the two nights she and Courtney spent in the hospital together. It would also be the last. At 10:38 on the morning of Saturday, October 7th, 2017, Courtney Bell made this 911 call.
Eaton County 911, what's your emergency?
I just woke up. My dog woke me up on the couch. I have a two-year-old and I have a two-week-old. And my two-week-old is not in her sleeper. Her passy's on the floor.
She's not in her sleeper?
She's not in her sleeper. She's not here. I've looked everywhere. I've looked under clothes and everything.
What's your address, ma'am?
12145 Highway 36, Lot 31. Yes, Lot 31.
Do you think somebody took her, ma'am?
My child said, my 2-year-old said she's gone. And I've looked everywhere in the house, so I don't know another possibility.
What lot number are you at?
31.
Okay. And you said you were sleeping, woke up, and she was gone?
Yes. My 2-year-old came and woke me up.
That's
right. That's how it's on the count.
How old is she, ma'am?
2 weeks old.
Okay. Who else would have come in your house?
I mean, as far as I know, nobody would have came in my house. My 2-year-old says, Papa, but I called my dad and I called my grandparents and they don't have her.
Okay.
My dad's on the way here now.
Okay. All right. How long have you been asleep?
The last time I woke up with her was around, I guess, 5 maybe.
Okay. So you were asleep since 5 o'clock?
I didn't even mean to fall asleep on the couch. I sat down for a minute after dealing with her all night.
Entry, or can you tell if someone's been there? Is her blanket there or gone?
Her blanket's gone. Her passy's here on the floor. Her blanket's not with us. I don't know where. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's with her.
Okay.
And I have clothes and totes. But I've looked all in them, and she's not here.
Anything else missing, like a baby bag that she would have, or anything else?
No, her bottle's here on top of my shelf.
Okay. What about
no,
you?
It's in my bathroom on my vanity. I'm sorry.
Ma'am.
Huh?
What about anything else that could possibly have gone, like could be hers that could have gone with her?
No. Nothing else. Just her and her blanket.
Okay, so the only thing that's missing is her and her blanket.
Yeah.
He didn't talk to the dad or grandma or anybody else?
Dad was here with me. Dad just left, and he's walking around the park looking for her. Because my 2-year-old says, I asked her, did somebody come in and take her? And she said, yeah, but she's 2, so I don't know if
right.
I can believe that or not.
Did you look through everything, like under the bed?
Yes,
the
ma'am.
Bathrooms?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Kalia!
All right, what's your name, ma'am?
Courtney Bell, CourtneyBell.
Just to let you know, Courtney, they've been on the way out there. I'm just getting this information to update them, okay?
Thank you so much.
What's your phone number?
I'm not sure of this number. My phone busted the other day.
Okay.
This is my grandmother's phone. She's been letting me use.
All right, so you and the dad both were... I'm just trying to get an understanding so I can let them know because of the questions that they're asking me. You and the dad both were sleeping or he just came back home?
No, me and him woke up together. She woke us up together.
Okay. The two-year-old woke y'all up and told y'all that the baby was gone?
Yes.
Okay.
She was kind of freaked out. I mean, I don't know. Because she was just standing there beside the couch in the corner. And I told her, come here, and I loved on her. And then I told my baby's dad to go check on Kalia. And then he's talking about she's not in here.
Okay, well, the police should be in the area now.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. I'll go ahead and let you go, okay?
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
When officers from the Newton County Sheriff's Office responded to Lot 31, they entered the trailer to find Courtney Bell in a panic, her hair pulled back into a sloppy ponytail, dressed in an oversized pink T-shirt bearing the slogan, "I'm not bossy, I'm the boss," a pair of Chris's green boxer shorts, and slippers. Courtney's left eye was visibly blackened, although the bruising appeared to be fading. Two-year-old Cece hovered nearby, wearing only a diaper. Also present was Missy Taylor, who Courtney had called almost immediately upon realizing Kalia was missing. The trailer was packed with items on every surface and in utter disarray, which did not appear to be solely the product of the morning's frantic search. There were clothes, toys, dishes, and assorted debris absolutely everywhere, and plastic tote boxes studded almost every room, bursting at the seams with clothing and other items. The dining room table was also covered with items, including an infant car seat, a laundry basket, a large purse, and a box of diapers. Courtney told police that she and Chris had last seen Kalia, who was by then 14 days old, around 5 a.m. when they fed her and changed her diaper before Chris put her back to bed. While he did that, she said, she sat down on the couch and, although she didn't intend to, fell asleep. Chris soon joined her on the couch and passed out next to her, and the next thing she knew, they were awakened by the sound of Cece fussing next to the couch. While she comforted and loved on Cece, Courtney explained, she sent Chris to the back bedroom to check on Kalia, and moments later, she heard him shout that the baby wasn't there. When they asked Cece where baby Sissy was, Courtney said, the little girl replied,
gone.
Courtney said she called everyone she could think of who might have come and taken Kalia, but no one knew where the baby was. The officers asked where Chris was, and she told them he was out walking around the mobile home park looking for Kalia. When they asked if she actually saw him leave the trailer, she immediately became defensive, saying,
y'all have got the wrong idea.
They assured her they were only trying to clarify the information they had been given. While officers performed a perfunctory search of the house, Courtney sent Chris a Facebook message telling him the police were there and asking where he was. The prepaid phone had run out of minutes the night before, but it apparently still had data because Chris received the message and replied that he was on his way back. As he approached the trailer, Tim, who had arrived in the meantime, told an officer,
well, that's the one you need to be talking to right there. That's the one you're looking for.
Investigators fanned out over the trailer park, speaking with neighbors and searching in, around, and even underneath trailers, and the search quickly spread into the adjacent woods. A canine, given Kalia's scent from the liner of her rock-and-play sleeper, led officers into the woods, but it stopped in a general area and did not pinpoint any location in particular. It did, however, seem to follow the route Chris McNabb had taken when walking through the woods earlier that morning. By early afternoon, deputies had transported Chris McNabb and Courtney Bell separately to the Newton County Sheriff's Office, where they would also be interviewed separately. Chris was interviewed first at 1:20 p.m. by investigators Jeff Alexander and Natasha Henderson, who had recently been transferred into the Criminal Investigations Division and was essentially being trained. Chris was read his Miranda rights and signed a waiver. When describing how Tim and his parents took the girls on October 3rd, Chris told the investigators that Courtney's family strongly disliked him, even physically attacking him, and that as a result, he went out of his way to avoid them.
People put their hands on me every time they see me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, actually, the old guy hit me with a stick probably a month ago through the window of my car. And probably 2 or 3 weeks before that, his son pushed me.
Chris's story was that when Tim brought the children back to them on October 6th, they spent the day as a family.
Well, everything was good. All it was loving on the baby because I just missed them so much. Because she's been around longer and I've got so attached to it, you know what I'm saying? Well, and I mean, I'm just loving my baby, you know what I mean? Just loving my kids. And, I mean, all it really was regular family living all day.
According to Chris, Cece went to bed between 8 and 9 p.m. that night, but Kalia, as a newborn, was different.
She sleeps all the time, so, you know, it's not really a bedtime for her. I get it, you know, we'll take turns feeding her or whatnot. Well, I mean, we're always up and down all night, you know. Might get 30 minutes here, an hour there. You know, I had a newborn and I'm sitting back here. So, the very last time that I actually held my baby in my arms, in my, the one that's been quick, I was feeding her her bottle on the bed and bedroom.
He wasn't sure of the time of this last feeding. He said he wasn't really paying attention to it. He thought it was between 3 and 3:30 a.m., but he said Courtney thought it was around 5. He said Kalia drank about half a bottle at that last feeding.
She ate almost like half a bottle. She drank almost half a bottle. And she was good. I mean, she was crying. You know, once I went home, she cried. But still, I'm hungry. But I bundled her up. Like, what was it? Tight as a love, and I rubbed her. Well, I bundled her up, and I put her in the thing in front of the air conditioner. I shut the door.
Chris said that when Kalia went back to sleep, Cece was asleep in the toddler bed next to her. At that point, he said, he went to the living room and went to sleep on the couch next to Courtney. Around 9:30, Chris said, he was awakened by a text on Courtney's phone, which was on the coffee table. The message was from Chris's dad, Michael, who was at his home in Tennessee, and said he was going to the store in a little while to send Chris some money via Walmart to Walmart because their rent had been due the day before. Chris said he worked for his dad, although he hadn't worked at all that week because of the turmoil caused by their kids being taken from them by Courtney's family. After thanking his father, Chris said, he checked on the kids, who were both still sleeping in their beds, so he went back to sleep on the couch with Courtney. The next thing he knew, Chris said, they were awakened by Cece, who was upset and acting strangely.
Well, the next thing I know, my little girl is in the living room, and she's like, crying, but not like super crying, you know what I mean? Just whining. And I woke up to that, and my baby's mom asked her, "What's wrong, baby? What's wrong?" And she's acting funny. She kept like backing up behind the couch, like she would get like, you know how the couch is sitting. All right, well, when you come down the hallway, you come to the side of the couch. So she kept backing up to the side of the couch, like in the corner of the wall of the couch, like she was trying to hide or something.
Chris told the investigators he got up and went down the hall to check on Kalia, but he saw from halfway down the hall that her rocker was empty. He and Courtney thought Cece had picked her up and put her somewhere because she had attempted to pick up the baby before, and they had to take Kalia away from her.
So, my baby's mom was like, "Go ahead and check on Kalia." So I got up, and as soon as I got halfway down the hallway, I seen that there wasn't anything. I went on ahead and went in there to make sure. Well, the first thing I noticed was that she wasn't there. So I was like, oh my God, I started freaking out. You know what I mean? I'm thinking that my little girl's gonna pick her up. She got a bad habit of picking her up and trying to carry her around. I've had me and my baby's mom both had to take her from me several times, every day. So, I tell my baby, I holler in there. I'm like, "She's not in here, baby, she's not in here." And so I started tearing the house up, like looking for it, and my baby mom was doing the same thing, calling her name, and we didn't hear no crying. When I didn't hear no crying, pretty much figured, I mean, if baby was in the house, surely, if my little girl would pick her up, put her somewhere, she'd probably be crying, she wouldn't be comfortable. Didn't hear no crying, so I'm still like going through everything, you know what I mean? And this wasn't there. And so I went out the back door. And that's how I know the back door was unlocked, because I didn't have to unlock it when I went out of it. I was in my underwear. I walked all the way around the trailer looking up under the trailer, trying to see anything. You know, maybe something she might have dropped, maybe something whoever might have dropped. I didn't know what I was doing. I was panicking.
Courtney called her grandfather Jack Bell, and the man's first reaction, according to Chris, was essentially to accuse him.
And we're freaking out. And she calls her papa. And the first thing her papa said, "Well, where's that damn boy at?" And I was already crying and I was trying to keep it together. And I was like, she started cussing me out like, what the fuck? Why is that your first question? What about, it's about the baby, not about him. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, what the hell did he just say? And she's like, "He wants to tell where you were at." And I was like, I kind of yelled at, because I knew what he was thinking. Because everything bad that happened is my fault. Everything. It don't matter what it is. If I'm not even around, if I'm 3,000 miles away, it's always my fault.
Courtney then called Melissa Taylor, or Missy, who came to help them look.
So I put my clothes on. That's when I noticed this tote that was on top of the other tote over there by the place where my baby sleep was on the bed. Like somebody had moved it. But I didn't think nothing of that time. I was just thinking about trying to find my kid. You know what I mean? I ruffled through it just to make sure that he wasn't in there. You know what I mean? So I put my clothes on. And I was pacing back and forth, looking, just looking around, going through stuff, opening up the stove, the refrigerator, everything.
Chris said he walked out of the trailer and went into the woods to start looking, taking only his flashlight and his phone. He said he came across a pair of brown men's shoes, and he claimed he was confused about why anyone would leave his shoes in the woods. He came out of the woods at Henderson Mill Road and took a right, walking up to a girl he knew named Sarah's house, and stood in her driveway for a minute. At that point, Courtney messaged him and said the police were there and wanted to know where he was, so he told her he was on his way back. When Chris arrived at the trailer, three officers confronted Chris and started asking him questions. Next in the interview, Investigator Alexander asked Chris if he thought his own father would take his child.
I mean, I don't know. When my stepmom called my girl, I didn't even hear the conversation. She told me about it afterwards, but supposedly my stepmom asked her, can she get the baby for a month or two or three? Because she knows that goes in there and picks her up and, you don't want nothing bad to happen to the baby. My girl told her, no, I want my baby. I'm keeping my baby. And when she told me the story, I'm like, that's right, you did the right thing. I'm not giving my kid up to nobody. I work, I can take care of my kids, you know what I mean? I mean, I ain't got my eyes on every single second of every day. But I'm good at when she does pick her up like that. I always hear from her. She never dropped her. She never tossed her. Now, one time, I think the first day that they came back from the in-laws' house, she picked her up and she was upside down. When she picked her up, she held her upside down. I grabbed her from her. And she didn't even start crying. So I grabbed her so quick and I swallowed her and I rocked her. Mm-hmm. And she didn't even start crying. She was okay. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, my stepmom was asking if she had my kid. I think her reason was to keep her safe for my two girls. I don't make no sense to me. I don't understand why you can go to the traffic and call us. Well, let me see if they'll let me have it for 13 months. That's a newborn baby.
Mm-hmm.
You don't take a newborn from their mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe the dad, that's different. But not the mom. That's a whole other ballgame. You don't take nobody from their mom. And the reason why I feel so strongly about that is I don't have a mom. My mom don't have nothing to do with me. So my dad wouldn't do that. I don't think she would do that. I don't think they would, either one of them would come down here and take my kid in the middle of the night or in the morning or whatever. You know what I mean?
Chris told the investigators that his father, Michael, lived in Deer Lodge, Tennessee, where his stepmom lived full time, but Michael mainly stayed in Bear Creek Marina in a camper because their work was local. When asked who else would have a motive to kidnap Kalia, he named a former friend, Matt Lester, who, he said, had broken into their trailer 2.5 months before. Once he figured out Matt was responsible for the break-in, Chris said he confronted him.
I asked him about it. Did you break my house? Did you break my house? Did you break my house? And then started pulling and filming and stuttering, and I knew I beat the hell out of that dude. I ain't gonna lie. And I beat the hell out of it. And I pushed him down my back porch. I pushed him down the back stairs. But evidently, I don't think he went to the hospital.
Chris claimed that ever since the incident, Matt had been telling other people he planned to get even with Chris. Even so, he told the investigators he didn't think Matt would come in and kidnap his child.
He'd been running around saying stuff. People had been indirectly hearing from other people that he'd been talking about he's going to get. Sooner or later, he's going to get what he's been saying.
Now, this little fight would happen before the baby was even born, right?
Yeah, way before that. So, I mean, do I think that dude broke him, came in my back door, got my kid? No, I don't.
According to Chris, The last time he saw Kalia, she was wearing a purple onesie that said something like, "My daddy works out," on the front, along with a picture of an animal bench-pressing weights. She was wrapped in a blue baby blanket. He described the baby herself, saying she had black hair like his and that she weighed 5 pounds 4 ounces when taken to her first well baby visit on Thursday, October 5th, which Courtney later said was at Conyers Pediatrics on Brown Ridge with Dr. Khalid. Chris said he was usually the one who burped the baby.
I get things because I got the patience to do it longer because I love to have her in my arms. I love to love on her. You know what I mean? I like having my kids. You know? And it makes me feel like I've done something in my life. Like I got a reason for being here. I was in no kind of attributed to society. All I know is running down. And ever since I was born, I just feel different about my life. I feel like I've actually done something. Provided the world with something beautiful.
When they first discovered Kalia was missing, Chris said, he was hesitant for Courtney to call 911 because he was worried about going to jail since he was perpetually on probation. During the interview, it became clear that all of his texts with Courtney were through Facebook Messenger due to their lack of an actual phone plan. It was also revealed that in these messages, Courtney called him Daddy.
She called me Daddy.
Chris was asked if anything had happened to Kalia overnight, and he denied it, then went into bizarre detail about the texture and color of the baby's bowel movements. Getting him back on track, investigator Alexander asked if one of the crates or totes stacked next to the bassinet had possibly fallen on Kalia in the night and suffocated her. Chris denied that.
There was no doubt anything happened that would cause me to take my kid anywhere out of that house. Nothing happened to her. Nothing happened. I'm a pretty smart guy, so I know the questions they're asking what they're leading to. So, you know, did something bad happen to her where I felt like I needed to do something with her so nobody would know? Or something like that. Something along those lines, but no, it's not. That's not what's going on, I swear.
Swear to God.
Swear to God, but that was my 2 year old. Nothing bad happened to that little girl.
Chris was asked to describe Courtney.
Good old lady. The only thing that I've never liked about her is that when I try to tell her something right, something, like most of the time, she don't do what she's gonna do, regardless of what anybody has to say about her. She can't try to do it. She don't listen to advice hardly. Now, not only is she hard of her gathering, but as far as everything else, I mean, she's an incredible mother. Our kids love her. Well, he does. You can't tell if a baby loves a fly or not, really. But it's crazy, though. Stuck to her like wood. She don't have any bone in her body.
He said that 9 times out of 10, when he and Courtney would argue, it was usually about him spending a night with another woman. Yeah, I imagine that would cause some friction. When asked, he said Courtney used to hit him, but didn't anymore. The last time she hit him was in 2014, in the side of the head. As for Courtney's current black eye, Chris said he thought she probably went and got into a fight with a girl named Danielle that he had sex with, but she wouldn't have told him if that was the case. Seriously, this guy. When the investigators asked when was the last time he or Courtney did drugs, Chris said,
A week ago. I used to smoke weed on every time I had one. She ain't done drugs. As far as I know, she ain't done drugs since my first one before. That was, like I say, almost 3 years ago. 2 years and 8 months.
The investigators asked if Chris knew any reason someone would kidnap his child, and he said he didn't know. He didn't have any money for ransom. Listening to Chris being interviewed was painful for so many reasons, not the least of which was his fondness for the phrase, "you know what I mean?" This guy's like a real-life, much less likable, criminal version of Ernest P. Worrell.
Know what I mean? 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 Know what I mean?
At about 2:30 p.m., Jeff Alexander left the room to interview Courtney Bell. While Chris was interviewed by investigators Alexander and Henderson, Courtney waited in a separate interrogation room, accompanied first by Deputy Steve Walden and then by a Deputy James, who stood in the doorway and talked with her until investigator Alexander arrived around 2:30. Courtney was still dressed in nothing but her pajamas. The footage of her interview was even harder to hear than Chris's, so I won't be including many clips of this one. When asked about her black eye, Courtney told Deputy James that about a week before, after she'd given birth to Kalia, she had a fight with a girl Chris had been having sex with when she was pregnant. She explained that Chris had only slept with the girl, Danielle, one time, but after she caught him, he stopped talking to the other woman. What a prince. About the events of that morning, Courtney said both she and Chris woke up around 5 a.m. with Kalia. She had a weird habit of using childish euphemisms during her interview. One example was a statement she made to Deputy James about changing Kalia's diaper because she was poopying, so the couple changed her diaper together in the bathroom so as not to awaken Cece. They dressed Kalia in her onesie, her socks, and her sleeper, quieted her, and fed her. Courtney then went into the living room, sat down on the couch, and fell asleep while Chris was still in the bedroom with the kids. When Michael McNabb messaged Chris at about 9:30, Courtney said she didn't awaken. She only awoke around 10:15 or 10:20 when Cece came into the living room, standing in the corner of the wall and the couch, acting frightened. At that point, Courtney said she sent Chris to check on Kalia, who was gone. While talking through the events of the morning, Courtney told Deputy James she was a very light sleeper. When the deputy asked how she wouldn't have heard someone opening doors, walking around the trailer, or even pulling a car into or out of the driveway, Courtney said she had no idea. With Deputy James, Courtney addressed leaving her 2-year-old and her newborn with her cousin, saying she left the kids with Megan because she has kids of her own who Cece liked to play with. She also said she needed a mommy break, so she let them stay overnight. She claimed she was texting back and forth with Megan all day, and when Tim, Jack, and Barbara pulled up at the trailer on October 3rd to get the car, she had just texted Megan to tell her they were on their way to pick up the girls. She said Tim told her they were taking the kids and the car because she had abandoned the girls at Megan's for the night. Clearly her timeline was off because the girls spent 2 nights at Megan's, not just one. Regardless, Courtney said she let her family take the kids because she wanted to let things cool down and blow over, and she trusted that Cece and Kalia would be safe with them. However, she also said there was some level of abuse in her family's home. Her dad and her grandparents, she said, really wanted her and the kids to come back home and live with them rather than being with Chris, who they hated.
Like I said, they won't be there. They want to take care of me. Me not work, me not do anything, me not have freedom. Me constantly get cussed by my whole ball, constantly an argument. I mean, it can be an argument over my charger being plugged in somewhere. I mean, it's just the simple things that he starts cussing. I mean, I can't handle that. My nerves can't handle that. You can't get cussed all day long and still be okay with living at that place, you know?
The deputy asked if her family took the car because Chris was driving it, but Courtney explained that Chris didn't have a license and had never driven her car. She said her family simply didn't want Chris riding in anything they had paid for. While talking with Deputy James, Courtney repeatedly asked when she could get back to looking for her baby. She seemed genuinely confused about what could have happened to Kalia and wanted to find her. Investigator Jeff Alexander finally came in around 2:40 p.m., at which point Courtney was read her Miranda rights and signed the waiver form. Investigator Alexander asked Courtney about her black eye, and she reiterated her story about getting in a fight with the woman Chris had slept with, saying the fight took place in town between Kroger and the shoe department on Highway 278. About the events of the previous day, Courtney said that after they got the kids back on the 6th, they spent the day with the girls and no one else came over during the day. That evening, she said, her cousin and best friend Craig Weatherford, who is Megan Sorrell's brother, came over to check on them. He was there maybe 10 minutes, and he saw both kids alive and well. Regarding the morning of the 7th, Courtney told essentially the same story as Chris, saying when Cece woke them, whining and smelling sweaty, Courtney first went to the trailer next door, but the neighbor's vehicle was not in the driveway, and no one appeared to be home. She then returned to her trailer and called Missy Taylor, who couldn't find her car keys, so she ran down to Courtney's trailer on foot. Courtney asked Cece where baby Cece was, to which the 2-year-old replied,
"Gone."
Courtney said she called her dad, and while on the phone with Tim, he, Jack, and Barbara immediately started asking where Chris was, even though Courtney said it had nothing to do with him. She called her Aunt Kim, who said she was coming over. They looked all over the house, even in the fridge, the stove, and the trash can, and tore apart the multiple bins full of clothing scattered around the trailer. When asked, Courtney said she had no idea why someone would take her baby. She said she didn't have any enemies and didn't bother anyone. They hardly talked to their neighbors except Elaine and Miles next door, who weren't home when she banged on their trailer, although they later helped her landlord, Johnny, look around the trailer park for Kalia. When considering who might have taken Kalia, Elaine had been her first thought, Courtney said, because the woman was obsessed with babies but couldn't have children of her own. Her other first thought was that Cece had picked up the baby and moved her, but, she said, Cece had never dropped or hurt Kalia. Once, she said, Cece brought Kalia into the toddler bed with her, but she had never hidden her. Courtney said that around 3 a.m., she had stacked one clothing tote on top of the other next to Kalia's bed to block the nightlight next to the baby, which she thought might be interfering with Kalia's sleep. She said, however, that she made sure the stack of totes was stable and couldn't fall on the baby. When they discovered Kalia was missing later that morning, she thought it was strange that the tote she had stacked on top of the other one was now on the bed. Chris, she said, denied knowing how it got there. When Courtney checked the bathroom, she found the one-piece sleeper outfit Kalia had been wearing, which was white with orange and blue accents, on the vanity. She assumed the baby had been hot, so Chris had taken it off before bed. Kalia's orange Mickey Mouse pacifier was found on the master bedroom floor near her rock and play. According to Courtney, she usually tried to remember to lock the doors, but she had forgotten to do it a time or two. They had lost the key to the front door, so they rarely came in that way. When she went outside in her pajamas that morning to bang on the neighbor's trailer, she didn't remember having to unlock the door to do so. Investigator Alexander brought up the topic of drugs, and Courtney said the last time she did drugs was when she smoked weed a month and a half before, which means she was pregnant at the time. The last time she did meth, she said, was over 3 years ago. The reason she and Chris had fallen asleep on the couch the night before, Courtney said, was because they were watching TV and they didn't have a TV in the bedroom anymore. They had moved their bedroom TV into the living room after the Roku TV in the living room fell off a table and broke. They had slept in the living room 2 to 3 times since Kalia had been home, so it wasn't a remarkably unusual occurrence. Courtney told the investigators she was going to give police the baby's sleeper outfit for the dogs to get the baby's scent, but by then she had touched it, so they instead took the insert from Kalia's rock and play. However, Courtney said, Chris's clothes had spilled inside the rocking bassinet, so she wondered about scent contamination. Toward the end of the interview, Courtney started complaining about being cold and wanting a cigarette. After his interview with Courtney, Investigator Alexander returned to the other room where Chris McNabb continued to wait. He asked Chris what, if anything, Courtney asked him about the baby's disappearance that morning, and Chris said she asked him if anything had happened that he knew about, saying she was sorry she had to ask, but she had to know. When asked if Courtney could have done something accidentally to Kalia, Chris said if she had, she wouldn't have hidden it, because she's an honest person who doesn't like liars. Alexander asked him about the next-door neighbors, to which Chris replied that Elaine and Miles were crazy. He said Elaine was always commenting on their pretty baby and asking to hold Kalia, even though they continuously shut her down. Next, investigators Henderson and Alexander brought Courtney to Chris and left them alone in the interrogation room together, where Chris immediately whipped off his black and white hoodie and gave it to Courtney, who put it on backwards before collapsing into his arms, weeping. They talked about where Kalia could be, who might have taken her, and how cadaver dogs in the house and in the woods hadn't found her. Chris cautioned Courtney at one point,
"They're going to try and play us against each other."
The most telling moment of their conversation, however, was when Chris referred to Kalia in the past tense. I'm going to play you the clip, but I'll also quote it afterward because the audio isn't perfectly clear. I've edited the clip to remove dead space and make it slightly easier to hear.
In my heart, no, I just hope you would. In my heart, tell me no.
This is exactly what was said. Chris.
I love her. She was my baby.
Courtney.
Why did you just do that?
Chris.
Do what?
Courtney.
Why did you just do that?
Chris.
Why did I just do what?
Courtney.
You just said loved.
Chris.
I don't know, Courtney. You think I had something to do with this shit?
Courtney.
In my heart, no. I just hope you haven't. My heart tells me no.
Shortly afterward, Investigator Alexander returned to the room and informed the couple that they were being taken home. The search for Kalia was suspended at around 9 that evening and would resume the following morning. By the end of the day Sunday, the question of where's Kalia would sadly have an answer, but the flood of unanswered questions was just beginning. When I decided to cover Kalia's story for this week's episode, I had no idea the amount of research it would entail, and I quickly found myself falling behind schedule, so I apologize for this episode being a little bit late. I'm going to stop here for this week, but I'll pick up where I left off in the next episode. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for the conclusion of Kalia's story. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.